From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it's Labor Day, many people relaxing from their labors. But people in parts of South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida are spending this day driving away from beaches after mandatory evacuation orders and ahead of Hurricane Dorian, now a Category 4 storm, but still considered very dangerous, and heading first for Florida. Awaiting Dorian, John Lugerai. He's on Flagler Beach, a barrier island, north of Daytona Beach, at the Oceanside Beach Bar and Grill, which he co-owns. And John, of vulnerable populations, people in nursing homes, for instance, are being evacuated from your island, but you're staying?
Yes, basically the wife and the kids, we usually try to bring them a little more inland, either send them away on a flight to some family relatives up north, or rent a cabin somewhere about an hour inland, anywhere off the barrier island.
Well, so what did you send the kids to the cabin?
We've been waiting for this next update and just really seeing what's going on with the storm since they're so unpredictable, especially when they start evacuating the vulnerable. I mean, that's just kind of a heads up saying, you know, better safe than sorry kind of thing. So that's when me and my brother, we pull the trigger and we get our own vulnerable population out of the county or even the state.
Yeah, well, we're hearing from the Bahamas. I'm sure you're seeing those pictures and the reports.
Oh my goodness.
I know, a seven.
Prayers for them, for sure.
Yeah, a little boy drowned. And this is one of the strongest Atlantic storms ever recorded. That's got to be chilling.
We've seen a lot of devastating storms, right? Even with Hurricane Andrew being one of the most fearsome storms ever to hit Florida. If this thing even stays 100 miles off the coast, you know, we just seen that with Matthew. And Matthew was absolutely devastating. Almost had an island around the restaurant. You know, we lost big chunks of the road on each side of us. And, you know, it's unbelievable about what kind of damage that can occur. And the economic impact afterwards, like no one ever sees the before and after. The week before, all the sales you lose, employees that you lose to. And it took almost a year and a half to get back to where we are. And we finally started to see some light at the end of the tunnel. You know, this has been a very tough year for Flagler Beach as it is because of the major road construction. And this was repairing from 3 years ago from Matthew.
Right. Well, and so that raises the question. By the way, you say you see the light at the end of the tunnel, and there's that saying, we see the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's a train, you know.
Bearing, you never know what's going to happen.
Bearing down on you. And so still, the question, why are you staying? I know the restaurant's made of concrete. With an aluminum roof, that roof could go. You have workers. While we were getting ready to talk, I heard you talking to your chef. So if you stay open, others stay there to work with you. Are you worried about the risk?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're definitely not putting anyone's lives at risk. You know, we have more than 36 hours to evacuate from any severe impact from the storm. You know, we're usually the last ones to close and the first ones to open. And we do this for our community. And everyone looks like this morning I've had anywhere from, even though we are closed, I had some locals still come in and I'm still taking care of them. And police chiefs, I mean, we have people still need money, they still need hours. Yeah. So the people that are choosing not to leave, hey, voluntarily, if you want to come in, this is what we're doing. Like, we're prepping every amount of food that we have in here, and we're going to go donate it to any shelters, because at the end of the day, that's going to be lost, and we're trying to prepare for that.
So you see yourself as a service to the community to have food on hand for people who are there, but also providing income for people who work with you. Look, this is an area that is vulnerable. There's a huge project there, protective berms along your shoreline. That finished in February, $20 million project. But we're hearing about, you know, rising waters, Florida sinking. Is there a part of you saying, you know, when do we decide to pull up stakes for good? Or maybe that's an unfair question as you've got a storm bearing down on you now.
Well, you know, it's something, it's just realistic views and what can happen. You see so many different catastrophic events. And the king tide, I mean, the king tide, I can't believe that the timing of this, you know, the water is so high, even over my dock already, and the storm isn't, you know, still 36 hours away. You know, it's just one of those things to where the timing of this storm, if we were ever going to go under and flood, this would be it. And this is going to be a true test to see what's going to happen. What is Flagler Beach future going to look like? Or even the Florida Central Coast? Because so much of us have been impacted just in the last few years. To see these many storms back to back is pretty unheard of.
Yeah. King tides, the highest tides possible. And you've got that in addition to one of the biggest Atlantic storms ever recorded bearing down on you. But you're saying you will go if it seems too risky.
My brother has been our anchor here. He has an H1 Hummer, and he usually is the first one to report on the scene. And he feels that it's his duty. We've been here now for three generations. I mean, we have everything here. And if this gets wiped out, we literally are left with nothing. But at the end of the day, you know, we pray and we thank God, and hopefully, you know, we're not going to go through any crazy amounts of devastation. But believe me, we are staying, but we are fully prepped. We have the tools, we have the resources. So I urge everyone, if you're not fully prepared, if you don't have a vehicle with a snorkel on that can get through 5, 6, 7 feet of water, then you get out. I mean, and we're fortunate enough that we do have tools at our disposal that will keep us safe.
That's John Lucherai, co-owner of the Oceanside Beach Bar and Grill on Flagler Island, the Barrier Island, just north of Daytona Beach, and that's where he's been talking to us. And John, we just wish you the best. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's go now across the country to the waters off Southern California, off Santa Cruz Island, where the Coast Guard is searching for more than 30 people missing after their scuba diving boat caught fire earlier this morning. NPR's National Desk correspondent Kirk Siegler is outside the Coast Guard station back on the mainland. This is in Ventura, California. And Kirk, we know officials just spoke with you there. 39 people on board this boat. Some were rescued?
That's right. We just heard from the Coast Guard not too long ago and confirmed there were 5 crew members on the deck who were awake at the time of the fire, who apparently were able to jump off the boat into a Good Samaritan rescue boat that came by. The Coast Guard also told us, Coast Guard Captain Monica Rochester, that everyone else, presumably most of the divers who were there on the trip, were asleep below when the boat was engulfed in flames.
Oh, boy. But we're reading some reports that it was only 20 yards offshore in Santa Cruz.
Sure, it was moored there for the night, we can assume, this being a very popular destination in the Channel Islands National Park. It's about 20 miles or so off the coast from where I am. I'm talking to you from the U.S. Mm-hmm. Coast Guard station here in Ventura. And yes, 20 yards off shore, it sunk, completely sunk, all but its bow. At one point, you could see its bow, according to officials, in 64 feet of water. It's still, we're being told, an active search and rescue operation. I should say, as is typical this time of year, off the coast of Southern California, there's often a lot of fog. When I arrived here earlier this morning, it was dense fog. I don't know if that's been, it's now burning off, as is typical, but I don't know if that's been hampering rescue operations. But we are not being told much at this point. We just know that it's still an active operation. Mm-hmm. There are very, you know, legitimate concerns that there are potentially many deaths.
Well, as we said, it was a scuba trip scheduled for 3 days starting Saturday. This is according to the website Truth Aquatics, which is a Santa Barbara tour operator. But it doesn't sound good, Kirk. I mean,
No, and this was a popular, very well-known boat company locally. The authorities told us they didn't have any prior, issues with a safety record or anything else like that. They had been in full compliance. We're still learning the details. As I'm talking to you, there are a lot of concerned family members showing up. Just a minute ago, actually, I watched this kind of, as you might imagine, a heartbreaking scene of a couple being escorted by a Coast Guard official. The woman was weeping, and they were heading just near me, behind me here, is where, I guess you'd call it the triage center, where a lot of family members and friends of the victims are gathering, and don't have much information at this point, but I think it's safe to say they're fearing the worst.
Well, you say the coroner has said as much.
That's right, the Santa Barbara County Coroner. As is typical in a situation like this, the authorities prepare for the worst. We don't know that that's, in fact, the case yet, but the Santa Barbara County Coroner, public relations officials for the county, tweeted out that they are preparing for a mass casualty event.
I mean, just potentially a horrific accident at a beautiful spot. I mean, you mentioned that Santa Cruz Island, it's one of 5 in the Channel Islands National Park. It's operated largely by the National Park Service and then part of it by the Nature Conservancy. People hop over there all the time.
It's a National Park Service,
People hop over there.
It's a very popular place to go.
Yeah.
And very popular place to go in a busy holiday weekend. And there are no services on the island or near it. It's all primitive and wilderness area. So information coming out of there has been slow for us so far.
Yeah. NPR's Kirk Siegler reporting from Ventura, California, where the Coast Guard over on Santa Cruz Island, about 20 miles from where he is still searching for more than 30 people missing after what seems to have been a terrible boat fire on Santa Cruz Island in a trip, scuba diving trip that started Saturday. Kirk, thanks so much for staying on this for us. Thanks very much.
Glad to be here.
As we keep an eye on Dorian bearing down on the East Coast, let's go again to the West and California, where lawmakers are considering a bill that could rewrite the rules of the gig economy. Assembly Bill 5, as it's called, would expand on and codify the recent California Supreme Court decision that companies like Lyft and Uber must classify their workers as employees rather than independent contractors if those workers fit a simple profile. Under the new bill, which has passed the state assembly and is expected to pass the Senate before lawmakers adjourn September 13th, drivers, manicurists, exotic dancers, and more would all likely become employees with benefits that the companies say they can't afford. Mustafa Maklad is an Uber and Lyft driver in the San Francisco Bay Area. Mustafa, we know you came to San Francisco from Egypt 5 years ago. You were an activist in Egypt during the strife there. Your mother feared for your safety. You came here to study. You're getting a master's in cybersecurity. And that's one of the reasons you started driving. You don't want to have college debt. But what else appealed to you about Uber and Lyft?
When I first came here, just like any other students or like refugees or asylees in the country, we're not able to use our degrees or our experience that we had in our countries. So we tried to make living for ourselves and our families.
In other words, you're saying that, you know, all the resume that you had in Egypt didn't help you get a job here.
No.
Yeah. And so driving, now what was it about Uber and Lyft that appealed to you?
The job was actually very easy to start. Like all you need is to have like a clean driver license and just a clean car. So the majority of people who come to the country first, this is usually like the first job they do because it's very easy to start your life with. Mm-hmm. And back then when I started, we actually used to drive for like 30 to 40 hours a week and meet ends by just doing 30 to 40 hours. But throughout the years, Uber and Lyft has been changing their policies to make our job harder. Yeah, they get more and more rich throughout the policies that they do. And the main thing that they keep changing is decreasing how much money they pay to drivers. So right now, in order to make the same amount of money I used to make when I started, I have to drive 70 to 80 hours at least every week.
Oh, and that's in addition to studying. But still, some would say we understand that that's about $2,000 a week, maybe $8,000 a month. Very good pay, good hours. You can, you know, make your own schedule. But as you say, you are one who's pushing for Assembly Bill 5 and this idea that you would be an employee instead of a gig driver because you think it will be better for you. What will be better?
Well, to start with, like what you said, like $2,000 a week. But on the other side, the cost of living, especially in San Francisco and the Bay Area, is keep getting more and more expensive year after year. And instead of our payments going up, it keep going down, which forces us to actually drive at least 70 to 80 hours a week. And that's like at least 12 hours every day. That makes us like don't have even the time to do anything else in our lives. And if that change, if we had AB5 plus union, because AB5 itself doesn't fix the issues that we have. So we need a union with AB5. And that will change everyone's life that who's driving. At least we will have the time and a little bit luxury to have time for ourselves and our families. a lot of drivers have families and kids. They don't even have the time to just go spend it with their kids because we have to drive like 12 hours every day.
Well, on this Labor Day, we remember to thank unions for the benefits that we do have at work, the fact that we have weekends, that we have holidays, that children of a certain age aren't allowed to work, and a lot of the things that labor laws require that companies like Uber and Lyft would have to provide if this law passed are union benefits that were hard fought for. But there's Social Security, unemployment insurance, health benefits, a minimum wage, the right to form a union. That is what you want and other drivers want. But Uber and Lyft and some of these other companies are saying that that will kill the goose that laid the golden egg because they will not be able to exist if they have to do the same things that other companies have to do. That's the underpinning of a gig economy, that they couldn't handle all those expenses.
Well, the only thing I can respond to that, let's look how much a company like Uber net worth is right now. Their net worth is more than $75 billion. And I'm sure when they started, they weren't that much worth. And it's just something they're trying to say so they can just try to avoid the responsibility for drivers and for all the workers that who built the company to become what it is right now.
Well, and what if they do go out of business? Someone like you would have to go into the taxi business, which is also at the beginning, you know, very expensive. In fact, taxi drivers have, you know, long been resenting drivers like you because they have to pay for things like medallions to own the cabs. I mean, the benefit of the gig economy is that you own the car. I'm pushing back on you because you know this is what the companies say, that they offer you your own schedule. You have your own car. You can do it at your own leisure.
Well, AB5 is not going to push a company like Uber out of business. AB5 only clarifying workers, whether they are independent contractors or employees. If Uber want to keep running their business, they still need to treat drivers with dignity and respect. And that's something not going to push them out of business.
By the way, the bill, which makes it harder to classify workers as independent contractors, is codifying an employment test that came from that 2018 California Supreme Court decision. It's the ABC test. It says for a worker to be a contractor and not an employee, they must meet three conditions. They must be free from the control and direction of the hiring entity. This would be Uber. They must perform work outside the usual course of the hiring entity's business and must be engaged in an independent job or business of the same nature as the work they do. And people are saying, well, that means that, you know, Uber doesn't qualify because B says you must perform work outside the usual course of the hiring entity's business. And all Uber does is Uber trips with drivers like you. So this automatically would disqualify Uber and Lyft. Look, tell us a little bit about what you're hearing from other Uber drivers. You say that some come from other places to work in San Francisco, sleep in their cars?
Yeah. The majority of drivers in San Francisco are actually people come from like other areas like Sacramento, Modesto, Stockton. I have seen people drive all the way from LA and San Diego and even Vegas just to drive in San Francisco to be able to make money. And with the little and the way that they keep decreasing how much money they pay drivers, most of these drivers doesn't even have the luxury to even buy a bed or like rent a room to sleep in every night that they come here to drive. So a lot of them are actually forced to sleep in their cars to be able to save money.
You've already answered the question of people who might ask, why don't you just do something else, you know, while you put yourself through school? It's very hard for you to get a job being from Egypt. Your resume there doesn't apply here. But what about moving somewhere else? San Francisco is unbelievably expensive. Do I understand you and six others share a $4,000 a month apartment? It's only got two bedrooms. Everybody's crammed in there. But why not go somewhere less expensive?
Because other cities, like you don't get the opportunity for work like you have here in San Francisco. And a job like Uber and Lyft, like if you drive, for example, in Sacramento, you have to drive double the time that you drive in San Francisco to not even make the same money. You would be making way less than what you make in San Francisco. That's why people from all over California come to drive in San Francisco.
Hmm. By the way, we mentioned that you were in the April 6th youth movement in Egypt. A really contentious time, trying to overthrow an autocratic government there. Many of your friends have been jailed. Do you find it odd that you came from that and to the United States, where you're finding yourself an activist again, this time wanting to back a law that would change a company like Uber?
Well, I was raised to stand up for what's right. And when I see the injustice that all the drivers has to go through, and not just drivers, a lot of workers has been misclassified and been mistreated by their employers. In the end, we are workers. It doesn't matter if we are independent contractors or employees. We are workers. And they are, Uber and Lyft specifically, are trying to go out of their ways to neglect all the responsibilities towards us as drivers.
Mustafa Maklad, an Uber and Lyft driver in the San Francisco Bay Area who's been organizing in support of AB 5. That's the California bill now making its way through the legislature there that will require companies like Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, companies in the gig economy, to categorize their workers as employees, not contract workers, under the ABC definition of the law, in which case they'd have to pay them a lot of benefits. Mustafa and others hoping that that happens. Mustafa, thanks so much for speaking with us, and happy Labor Day.
Thank you, too.
Well, we're going to keep taking a look at the gig economy. Is it sustainable, especially with pending bills like California's AB 5? And on this Labor Day, is the gig economy working for you? Weigh in at hereandnow.org. The attention here in the U.S. has been on hurricanes bearing down on Florida and a shooting in Texas. But the protests in Hong Kong also continue. And today, high school students added gas masks, goggles, and hard hats to their formal uniforms as they participated in a strike on the first day of school. These are the latest demonstrations in nearly 3 months of protests. Remember, they were triggered by legislation that would have allowed extradition of Hong Kong residents to mainland China to face trial. NPR Beijing correspondent Emily Fang joins us from Hong Kong. Emily, tell us more about what's going on with these students. What did you see and hear?
Well, the rallies have ended, but when I was there, they were very peaceful and organized. I mean, thousands had packed onto campus. Some of them were even standing on top of the buildings and hanging out of the balconies to get a glimpse of what was going on. They waved flags that said, "Restore Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times." That's been one of the key slogans in the protests. And the peaceful nature was not a surprise to me. Most of the movement over the last 4 months has been very courteous, very organized. Unfortunately, nighttime clashes have become more common. But for the most part, volunteers leave water for marches, give food to journalists. Today, people are handing out batteries to radio journalists like me to make sure that we had enough power. And so, things were very orderly today.
Okay, we remind people, Hong Kong is the former British colony. It was returned to China in 1997. So the backbone of these protests isn't just that law about extradition, people maybe being sent to China for trial. It's about a complete fear that the communist-ruled China is going to, you know, take away all the civil liberties in Hong Kong. So where do you see endgame here?
It's really hard to say, and that's what I ask every single protester and student leader that I talk to. They are not sure what's going to happen, but there's kind of a sort of nihilism, which is that they say whatever Beijing decides to do, Hong Kongers at least put up a really good fight. And one of the new slogans that's emerged in the extensive graffiti that some of the protesters leave behind at night is, "I would rather be ashes than dust," which translated means they'd rather go out in a blaze of glory than be passively destroyed. Mm-hmm. Now, there likely isn't going to be anything violent that happens before October 1st, because that's a big political anniversary. It's the 70th birthday of the communist government in China. And so Beijing is trying to avoid any splashy stuff in Hong Kong from making headlines. But there is a fear in Hong Kong that something bigger is going to happen soon.
Well, and we've already had, when you talk about go out in a blaze, you know, this weekend on Saturday, police at a subway station were swinging batons at passengers in a train car. There's been pepper spray used, water cannons, tear gas, rubber bullets. The demonstrators have been throwing gasoline bombs. This already has had an escalation.
It has. This weekend was the most violent on record since protests began in June. And I was there when protesters were outside police headquarters and they set that massive fire across a major road. But riot police came in really quickly and then spent the entire night chasing down protesters, sometimes in really brutal fashion, and going after some people who weren't even protesters. You mentioned the metro station. There were many stations where police just swooped in and began pepper spraying people who just happened to be there. And so that's further infuriated people. And unfortunately, the protesters feel that Carrie Lam, Hong Kong's chief executive, has not listened to their demands for direct democracy. And Carrie Lam and the people who are backing her in Beijing also have given no indication that they will back down.
That's NPR Beijing correspondent Emily Fang in Hong Kong. Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
So we've all seen the pills and yogurts that promote themselves as probiotic supplements. But new research shows that perhaps the most probiotic aid out there is the one your grandmother promoted, the apple. And other fresh fruits and vegetables aren't far behind. Probiotics are alive bacteria that are important for gut health. Yes, the many microorganisms inside us known collectively as the microbiome. Over the past couple decades, we've come to better appreciate the need to have diverse kinds of bacteria. Don't kill them all with antibiotics. They're essential. But it can be difficult to know what kind of bacteria your gut needs or how much it needs. Probiotic supplements say they boost good bacteria, offset antibiotics, but they're not always effective. Many are barely regulated, and what's good for one person may not be good for another. Plus, it can change over the course of a life. Dr. James Hamblin writes about all of this in a recent issue of The Atlantic, where he's a staff writer. His article is The Best Probiotics. He joins us from New York. And Jim, you're taking in all the research. You conclude there is an alternative to supplements, probiotics like yogurts and fermented foods like sauerkraut. And that is fresh produce, in particular, the apple core. Explain that.
Yeah, well, that happens to be what this latest study was done on. We've known that produce contains microbes, and we're starting to quantify that and figure out which sorts are in which kinds and how they should be consumed to ideally get the best microbes. That's far off. But an apple itself, an average apple, has about 100 million different microbes in it. So it's not a ton, you know, on the scale that we're talking about, but it's still a lot. And it's a reminder that we've had these enduring questions like, why should an apple be healthier than taking a multivitamin that has the same nutrients in it? And you realize there are all these components to it, like the fiber and the microbes, that are interacting with our gut biome and stimulating our immune system in ways that they're still mysterious to us, but they're sort of confirming the old wisdom that we knew it was healthier to eat a lot of good food. And this is a mechanism that might explain why.
Well, in part because the apple, as opposed to apple juice, you know, a processed food, has fiber. Fiber feeds microbes. And we're talking about, again, microbes inside the apple. We're not talking about, you know, a dirty apple. You know,
yeah.
It's not the skin of the apple. It's inside. And the core in particular, and you write that you have argued in the past, and this is just such an interesting sentence I don't think I've read before. I've argued in the past, if you eat the apple from bottom to top, the core, which some people might think, ugh, I'm not going to eat that, is barely noticeable. Really, you have argued this.
I have. I don't mean to stir up your listeners because this is a pretty polarizing subject. But if you – yeah, an apple core by itself, it's not as sweet as eating the rest of the apple. But when you take the bites from the bottom, the core becomes a smaller proportion of it and it's barely noticeable. And you're getting good fiber and it minimizes a little bit of food waste. So it's kind of win-win-win.
So what are you telling your readers who asked you, hey, I want to have a lot of microbes in my gut? What's the best probiotic? Are you saying don't take the supplements, eat an apple?
I am saying to think about supplements closer to the way you might think about medication. And I say this for nutritional supplements, too. There are going to be use cases for particular people who have particular dietary limitations and lifestyles and medical conditions. And that's why it's important to have a doctor who can oversee and say, you know, you are one of the people who would benefit from this. But like medicines, you know, like insulin or a high blood pressure medication, it's going to be extremely unlikely that we're just going to say, oh, yeah, everyone should be taking this. Everyone is going to benefit because – you know, not that it's exactly like insulin, but that is a life-saving medication for some people, which can kill someone else who takes it and shouldn't be taking it. So it's not going to be that dramatic. But anything that has a good benefit to our physiology could potentially have harms. So I would just – for what we know right now, yeah, there isn't a good case to widely recommend that people take any of these pills. And there is good reason to think that people should be getting – high-fiber diets full of fresh produce and minimizing antibiotic exposure and trying to keep the biome healthy in the ways that we've always known are good for us.
Keep your biome healthy. Eat an apple a day. Dr. James Hamblin, staff writer at The Atlantic, and we'll post his article, The Best Probiotics. It turns out it's an apple, or an apple core, to be more specific. I'm going to try that from the bottom up.
Oh, please do.
Yeah. Although, wait, you do mention, because the seeds taste so pungent and you note that they are cyanide.
You might want to spit the seeds out. No, you know, I have consulted experts on that who say that if you were to do that every day as an adult, that should be fine. If you're eating many, many, just the core, I would spit the seeds out. But one a day should not be a problem.
Dr. James Hamblin, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's check in now on the U.S. Open. It's been quite a refuge this weekend from terrible news, which we'll continue to follow. But how about that win by number one women's seed Naomi Osaka, who then helped her opponent, the 15-year-old Coco Gauff, turn her disappointing loss into an inspiring moment? And the men's number one seed Novak Djokovic retired from his match with a bad shoulder, very dramatic. We have the great Pam Shriver, ESPN analyst and former U.S. Open women's singles finalist herself, to review for us. Pam, no spoilers about today's matches, but recap the weekend, starting with Coco Mania. Gauff won her first couple of matches. The U.S. Open crowds were adoring her.
Yes, she's been quite the summer tennis story, starting at Wimbledon when she qualified, beat Venus Williams first round, lost to the eventual champion Simona Halep. All eyes on her singles draw here, and then it set up a much-hyped match against the defending champ, Osaka, who hasn't been looking as strong as she did last year or as fit. But let's face it, I mean, Osaka, just a bigger, stronger, better player right now, but it was the moments after the match that were magical.
Well, we'll talk about those, but just before the match, after all this, you know, fan love for Coco Gauff, you commentators almost had to remind people about how deserving Naomi Osaka is, because talk about her last win on that court.
Well, one of the most, if not the most, controversial match in tennis history was last year's U.S. Open final, playing against Serena Williams. Osaka playing her first major final, trying to win for the country of Japan, its first singles major. It just started to unfold in a way which was most unfortunate for everybody.
So a year ago, Serena Williams has, you know, code violations and different things happen on the court, but she pretty much has kind of a meltdown, and she robs Osaka of her stunning moment. You know, there's Osaka in tears. And now she has Coco Gauff, and yet after she beats Coco Gauff, she does this extraordinary thing. I think you and others were saying you've never seen anything like it. She offers Coco Gauff to come be part of the interview.
Well, just briefly before we leave, what happened last year is afterwards Osaka was upset. Serena did console her and then helped get the crowd to stop booing. Flash forward 1 year, and to see how Osaka, after beating Coco Gauff easily and trying to console her and saying to Coco, why don't you be a part of the post-match interview with me? You've had a great summer. And the two of them together, courtside, it was very emotional, but it was a beautiful moment of empathy and great sportsmanship from Osaka. And also, I think it gave Coco Gauff an opportunity to thank the crowd that had helped her not only here, but also at Wimbledon, just have a tremendous summer for a 15-year-old tennis player.
And after Coco Gauff had her very tearful interview. Here's Osaka addressing Coco's parents, because it turns out that the two of them used to train together. They'd see each other. They've known each other. Let's listen.
I remember I used to see you guys training in the same place as us. And for me, like the fact that both of us made it and we're both still working as hard as we can, I think it's incredible. And I think you guys are amazing. I think, Coco, you're amazing.
Oh, just, Pam Shriver, just speak about what this means for women in tennis, because sometimes in the past, it was said that the women weren't as supportive of each other, maybe, weren't as demonstrative, you know, at the net as maybe the guys were when there was a loss. I mean, maybe you think that's an unfair characterization, but is this changing?
I think in men's tennis, some of the battles they have that go 4 or 5 hours, sometimes their embrace up at net is quite special. It does happen in women's tennis, but maybe not as frequently. But let's face it, we've seen some great sporting moments this U.S. Open amongst all athletes. But the moment that may stand out above anything else at the end of the tournament, except for obviously when the two champions raise the trophy and win, will be this Naomi Osaka-Coco Gauff moment.
Yeah. Pam Shriver, ESPN analyst, former U.S. Open singles finalist. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
On this Labor Day, we're keeping an eye on Hurricane Dorian, covering the aftermath of the mass shooting in Odessa and Midland, Texas, and the fire on a scuba boat off the coast of California, over 30 people missing there. We'll continue to follow these stories throughout the day, but now a few minutes to hear how a jazz musician is giving a new interpretation to some of the folk songs collected by Alan Lomax, the ethnomusicologist, record producer, radio host, academic. He's credited with bringing Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, and Lead Belly to a wider audience. John Kalish reports.
When Andy Biskin landed in New York in the 1970s, fresh out of Yale with an anthropology degree and a clarinet, he went to work for Alan Lomax as a research assistant.
Alan had no use for the music that I was playing. He liked Dixieland and, you know, New Orleans music, traditional jazz. He thought that anything that came after that was fake.
Biskin played modern jazz at night and worked for Lomax during the day. By then, the great ethnomusicologist's career was on the downswing.
In the 60s, he had sometimes 8 or 10 people working in this office. It was like the Manhattan Project. And by the time I got there, the party had sort of ended. He was pretty much going at it alone.
But Biskin says Lomax was working on what he considered the culmination of his career, a program using computers to categorize music.
He developed a coding system where you could get everything that you needed to know about a song with 37 variables. And he had a sample of songs from around the world. And he put this all into a database with anthropological data. I mean, it was kind of crazy stuff.
It was one Sunday morning.
Lord, Lord, Lord.
The preacher went a-hunting.
Lord, Lord, Lord.
Biskin's process for adapting the music Lomax collected in his 1960 anthology, Folk Songs of North America, was decidedly simple.
It was really just putting the book on a music stand and playing the melodies on my clarinet. I was looking for melodies that seemed like they could withstand some serious abuse.
For his album 16 Tons, Biskin picked 13 tunes, including such well-known pieces as Blue Tail Fly, Tom Dooley, and She'll Be Coming Round the Mountain.
I knew that I didn't want it to sound like a folk band. I wanted horns. I also wanted a way to do like a call and response. There needed to be a chorus that could respond to my clarinet, and they had to sound different than me.
That chorus is three trumpets. Given Alan Lomax's fondness for Dixieland, it's hard to know what he would make of Biskin's reinterpretations of the old folk songs Lomax collected.
He said of Dave Brubeck back in 1950-something that the jazz guys had too many chords going. I suspect he would have thought there were too many chords going here, too.
Lomax biographer John Swid says he admires Biskin for staying close enough to the original melodies that they're recognizable while managing to create something new.
Andy's got a great feeling for the range of the clarinet, and he seems to know exactly how you can use the clarinet to get a kind of human voice quality. And it particularly was drawn by the piece that was using shape note singing, Am I Born to Die? I couldn't imagine three trumpets, a drummer, and a clarinet getting a shape note singing thing with all that goes with that at a very slow tempo, but it works beautifully.
Lomax himself might even agree. Andy Biskin says he ran into the ethnomusicologist 20 years after he worked for him.
He seemed to understand what I was doing, and he kind of made it known to me that I should not be in academia, that I should be playing music. It wasn't ever spoken to me in a real direct way, but I sort of felt like I had his approval, and that meant something.
Biskin's new project is a clarinet quartet that plays Mozart and Jelly Roll Morton. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
And this is Labor Day. It's also the unofficial end of summer. So quick thought, if you're traveling, check airlines. Many flights have been canceled because of Hurricane Dorian, but some airlines are waiving their change and cancellation fees. Some Amtrak service has been canceled. So just check before you move. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.